Welcome, I'm Pooja Sarkar and you're listening to the podcast from the bookshelves of Forbes India. Today we are going to speak to one of the veterans of Indian automobile industry, someone who started as an IAS officer in 1956 and later went on to work for Maruti Suzuki. I am so glad to welcome Mr. R.C. Bhargava, chairman of Maruti Suzuki. He has written the book Getting Competitive, which is launching this week, where he talks about India's economic policies for the manufacturing sector, tax reforms that are needed for auto companies and much more. In fact, in 1982, Government of India had signed a joint venture with the Suzuki Group from Japan to form Maruti Suzuki. And we will pick his brains on how the automotive sector is going to shape up in these times when the sector has been grappling with lower sales, job losses and a stressed economy. I am so thankful that you chose to come to our show. Thank you so much for being here and welcome to the show, sir. You talked about the Japanese way of life and doing business, and you extensively compared the Nehruvian policies and current Prime Minister Mr. Modi's policies throughout the book. What do you think are the most key important policy initiatives that you've seen over the years that stand out for you for both the regimes, and what have been their failures also? How could they have done better?
See, I think the biggest change which took place when Prime Minister Modi came to power was his emphasis on reviving manufacturing. And not only did he say that this is the most important item for India, but he started making a substantial number of reforms and changes in the direction of making it easier to do business in India and to reduce costs of doing business. To the best of my knowledge, and I go back now more than 60 years, I don't remember any other government which actually made specific attempts to make manufacturing more competitive, to make it easier to do business in India. Everybody talked about it. But talk is one thing, doing something about it is something else. And I think that is the biggest difference which has happened with the Prime Minister, the present Prime Minister, Mr. Modi, is that he's actually trying to do something. It's another matter that the results, for various reasons, have not been what one would expect them to be. But at least here you have a person who is committed to this, who wants to do it. Partly it depends on what kind of advice he gets, what kind of system he has inherited, what kind of mindsets people have.
True. There's one thing that you've written in your book. I really like this line where you said, poverty cannot be eradicated unless wealth is created in the economy. And then you also talked about how automobile contributes such a huge amount of workforce to our country. I would like you to take listeners through the fact, you know, how do you think that economy can get back into shape and what really needs to be done?
See, for some reason, and you know, this is not something which requires a very high level of expertise to know that you cannot give people a better quality of life in India, whether it's in terms of education, healthcare, sanitation, water supply, housing, infrastructure, if you do not have wealth in the country. And you have to keep creating wealth because also our population is going up. For some unfathomable reasons, it's very difficult for anybody to understand. So many governments in the past wanted to create a nice socialistic society, but without creating the wealth. They forgot that when Pandit Nehru started development in 1950, his idea was also to create wealth through industrialization and then to create an equitable society. So they remembered the equitable society, they forgot the rest. Still, Mr. Modi came and remembered it. And I heard also, for example, the Vice President talk about that you can't get socialism without creating wealth. And you mentioned Japan. The reason I was very impressed with Japan was that, you know, before I knew Japan, I didn't know what kind of society Japan had. But then I thought it would be a good capitalist society like everywhere in the West. But when I looked at Japan, I found that here is a country which is the most competitive in manufacturing, which has grown manufacturing to heights beyond what any Western country could do, despite not having either energy or material resources. And yet, where this country, though it doesn't profess socialism, is, I believe, the most socialistic country in the world. If you actually look at how people live and behave, it's the most socialistic country.
True. I remember you reading in the book where you talked about that they have this culture where, you know, you really cannot differentiate between the lifestyles of people who are poor or rich.
The biggest president of the biggest companies, often you'll find him walking around and behaving in a thing like any other normal person. Can you see that happening here?
No, that is true. So you started out as an IAS officer long back. You had such a long journey in the corporate world. Then you went to Bale, then you went to Maruti Suzuki. I wanted to take from your first car and which is still your best favorite car. And if you can take to the history of entire, you know, how Suzuki came into play in 1982 in India and how has the journey been with Maruti Suzuki?
Well, the first car which I owned was an Ambassador.
Oh, wow.
I bought it in 1960.
Wow.
And it was a very good car in the sense that I have good memories. In February 61, I had got married.
Okay.
And in this car, the two of us with no driver, nobody, we drove all the way from Delhi till Gopalpur on sea in Odisha and came back in the Ambassador with nobody else.
So that long in those days?
Yes.
Wow.
So that was my first car. After that, there was a gap because I had went to the USA to do an MA and all that. And when I came back after that, I only owned Fiats.
Oh, okay.
Till 1979, when I joined BHEL, then I had a staff car because I was a director. And that staff cars are all Ambassadors.
True.
So back to the Ambassador.
Okay. But coming to the story of Maruti Suzuki, and you know, you write extensively about, you know, how you'd close down the canteen for the managers and you said everybody has to eat together. And a lot of these small, nice anecdotes that you've filled in the book about Maruti Suzuki and the story of them being in India, the amount of cars that they sell, and how they became this behemoth in India for automotive. If you can take the listeners through it.
You know, the Indian system, we have a caste system, which is the traditional caste system. But there's another caste system, which is based on status and education and wealth. And that is what we were trying to break down in Maruti. That Maruti should not have a caste system. And just because I belong to IAS or somebody came from an IIT or somebody else did an IIM, they shouldn't think that they are superior in some way as persons to a worker who has only done an ITI diploma certificate. And that had been the effort right from the beginning, but that is what we learned, at least I learned, and Mr. Krishnamurti learned from the Japanese, that every person, and that's a fact if you look at it, that if you're working as a team, every team member has a role to play. And the company is as strong as the weakest link. So you have to strengthen all links. And the worker is therefore an important link in the factory. And therefore, if you think that you are superior to him and you're doing much more important work, then that link is not going to develop and become a strong link. It'll probably wither away.
True. And so you also talk about how Maruti Suzuki's business has grown in India over time. And you said that there's this interesting thing I liked about the book. It's that you wrote how in India, 28 people per thousand own a car, whereas in China, it's 150 per thousand. How do you see, right now we are going through this entire pandemic issue. Automobile sales have been slowing down over the last 1 year or so. How do you think can automotive companies start the cycle business again? Do you see, is there any visibility on when they can start?
As I have said in the book, it's both my ability to manufacture, but I can only manufacture as many cars as the customer is willing to buy. I mean, there's no point manufacturing cars if nobody is going to buy them.
True.
So the demand part is a very, very key factor for determining at what rate industry will manufacture and grow. Now, unfortunately, we have not in this country, well, we have in a sense, we have always had the feeling that manufactured products are meant for the rich. And because we wanted to bring in socialism, we thought socialism will come in by pricing products which are consumed by the rich at a high level. So taxes on not only cars, but refrigerators and washing machines and microwave ovens and various other products which are used, even tinned foods, preservative foods, processed food, all taxed very highly because these are all supposed to be for the rich. Now, two things we forgot, that if you do that, the price level will go up to a level where the market will be a very small segment of the population. And that segment doesn't grow very fast. And so industry will not grow. But the second thing is, if you really want to give people a good quality of life, there's no reason why more and more people who are today considered to be, let's say, lower middle class, should not aspire to use some of these products which are being used by the richer class. That is what development is all about, to get people to improve their living standards, their consumption standards. If today you say that in a hospital, the poor people have to stay 16 into a dormitory with no air conditioning, should we not aspire at some time to enable at least those dormitories to have air conditioning and better cleanliness and better sanitation? How can you do that if you don't make these products more accessible to people? So we have tax, for example, now you're talking of cars. Cars in India are taxed probably the highest in the world. And one of the reasons why, in what was it, about 1998 or something like that, China and India were at are in terms of the number of cars produced. In 20 years, China's production of cars has become something like seven or eight times our production of cars. And it's supposed to be a communist country. So, it's one thing to say you're communist or you're capitalist, but that's for people to hear. What you actually do and what people's lives are like is actually what you are. So the Chinese profess communism. Their industrial system is based on capitalistic competition. The Japanese profess capitalism, but their living is all socialistic. India does what? India professes socialism, but its industry is neither capitalistic nor socialistic. It's inefficient, that's all.
True. There is, you mentioned about the whole Monopolies and Restrictive Trade Policies Act of 1969, aping the entire USS model of growth at that point in time, which has also led to the fact it, earlier the government companies did not have any competition. Government did not want any competition to come in either from its own other companies or from the private sector, which later opened up. How has that affected us in the long run?
For some reason, our planners and economists and policymakers thought that competition resulted in waste. So they deliberately created a system which would not allow competition to come. But the result of that was we saw what happened in 1991. The country was virtually bankrupt in terms of foreign exchange. Inflation was running well into double digits. All our manufactured products had become obsolete. Quality-wise, most essential things were in short supply. So that is the result of not having competition and not having free access and entry into the industrial field. So the system of creating monopolies, whether it's a state monopoly or a private monopoly, will always, always hurt the customer. And if the customer is hurt, the country is hurt. Because the customers make up the country. It's not the manufacturer or the industrialist or the PSUs which make up the country. It's the customer who is the country. And we tend to forget the importance of the customer.
True. So while, you know, we have seen a lot of capital come in from the global private equity funds or in the form of FDI, strategic companies that are deploying capital in India. But over the last few years, we have seen that companies deploying CapEx has gone down. And it has gone down considerably from the larger corporates who were the driving force in India, in Indian corporate ecosystem. How do you think, is there a way to change that? And how do you think it has to move? So if you have to take a break, we can take a break.
So what has been happening is that while foreign direct investment into India has been increasing quite steadily. And often we have been quite happy with what has been happening. But when you look at that FDI, you'll find that what comes into manufacturing, an actual hardcore manufacturing and new projects, is very, very small. And for example, the number of companies who have moved out of China and how many of them have come to India? It's a very small number. So the reason is what this whole book is about, that conditions in India are not attractive enough compared to other countries for people to come and invest in manufacturing in India. They're willing to come to other areas, including drugs and technology and such things, but they're not willing to come into hardcore manufacturing.
True.
So CapEx in this area is drying up because demand is not increasing fast enough. Indian companies have spare capacity, so they also don't want to make investments. So the net result is CapEx in manufacturing is slow.
And so how do you think, going forward, would there be a movement in CapEx because A, we are going through this pandemic and companies are going to see massive amount of erosion in their revenues in the coming quarters. How do you think things can move forward from here?
See, I think this is an excellent time for us to take stock of where we are in manufacturing and why we are not competitive. And I think government is doing just that because they have also realized that manufacturing in India needs to become much more attractive for people to invest in. And which means cost of manufacturing, which means the rate of growth of demand for manufactured products. It means availability of skills. But overall, it means that people must find it easy to manufacture in India and manufacture with quality and cost, which will enable those products to compete successfully anywhere in the world. That is what an investor wants. And that is the conditions which we have to create in India. And this is the time to do it.
Also, sir, in terms of exports, India isn't really that high in when it comes to exports. Are there other policies that you see that are needed when it comes to exports?
See, again, we keep announcing various policies that will give incentives for exports and we'll get high priority and we'll waive this, that and the other. But those are not the real answers. The first requirement you have to have if you want to push up exports is that your products, in terms of their quality, in terms of their cost, in terms of reliability of supply, should be as good, if not better, than products from other countries. Then your products will be bought by customers outside India because they find that Indian products give better value for money. But if your products are inferior, you can't get people to keep buying those products on a sustained basis merely by subsidies and doles. I think our manufacturing organizations, exporters organizations, also make a mistake because they keep asking for financial concessions for exports. It's not the answer. The answer is how to make those products in India in a much more competitive manner.
True. You also argue in the book that it would be logical to fix total taxes on manufactured products, including state levies, so that the demand within the country is high enough to sustain the required rate of growth. If you could explain.
Yeah, because I believe the demand, ultimately the demand will be determined by the price and the affordability of the product to larger and larger segments of the population. Now, if your GDP is growing, let's say at 7% a year, per capita incomes are growing maybe around 5.5% a year. If you want to increase your market size, your product prices need to remain below that price, so they have to become more and more affordable. The cost to the consumer must not go up by 5% a year. It should remain the same or go up by 1% or 2%, so that if his income goes up by 5.5%, the product itself becomes cheaper because the price goes up by only 1% a year. Now, how to make that happen? And partly that has to come from the taxes, both central and state taxes, partly by reducing costs of production, in which government has a role to play, the entrepreneur has a role to play.
So the new wave of vehicles that are going to come across the world, when we talk about electric vehicles, and we are talking about cars without drivers, the world, it seems, was looking very different just before the pandemic on the kind of research and the policies that one wanted to bring around these new set of vehicles. How do you think India will move on that front? And also the fact that electric vehicles are expensive as compared to the existing models that are there. And now with so much of economic pressure coming in, do you think we will still be able to go ahead with the entire timelines on electric vehicles? And also the fact that would there be enough demand in the market in the coming times?
See, electric vehicles include two-wheelers, four-wheelers.
True.
And the government, I think, has recognized that two-wheelers need to be electrified before four-wheelers, because the requirements of infrastructure, requirements of keeping the costs affordable, are much easier on two-wheelers than it is for four-wheelers, where today, as you rightly said, the costs are such that they are unaffordable. The infrastructure is lacking. People's confidence in electric vehicles is lacking. So I don't see electric cars becoming a major product in India for some years to come. But I do see that there's a great necessity that two-wheelers first need to be electrified, and that's an area where our people should concentrate.
True. And so before I let you go for today, I had one last question, on how do you see the economy panning out because of the entire pandemic, because it has had such a impact on our economy, especially across sectors, especially automobile, because you've been seeing numbers go down? And second, how are you spending your time in the lockdown?
Well, I believe that the economy will bounce back fast. At least it can bounce back very fast, especially if we look at this pandemic as an opportunity to change many of the things which have held us back in the past. I think this is a very good opportunity to make changes. And if India becomes conscious of the need to create wealth by becoming competitive, by growing manufacturing, by everybody working together, by understanding the value of teamwork for beating others, then I think we will see a very rapid growth of the Indian economy. As far as what I do in my spare time, I've been working on this book. I have other things to do. I manage to keep, I'm quite happy staying at home, actually. It doesn't bother me if I don't go out at all.
Thank you so much for your time today.